tape. All right, tonight we're going to discuss 1988. So we'll go back in time 31 years, nine elections ago. In 1988, there were four options on the table in terms of security packages that the voters had to decide from. And these were total withdrawal from the territories, territorial compromise, autonomy for the Arabs of the territories, and annexation. Okay? So, the more things change, the more things stay the same. Who supported what option? Well, the Arab parties, of course, supported total withdrawal. Let's go back to the old pre-67 borders. Were there any Jewish parties that supported such a position in 1988? The answer is yes. Shulamit Aloni, Citizens' Rights Movement, RATS, favored 100% withdrawal if that could produce peace. All right? Yeah, okay, well. And maybe even if not. Then, who supported territorial compromise? Well, Mapam, the far-left socialists, Shinui, a party that tried to present itself as centrist but really wasn't, it really was to the left, and the Labour Party, the Alignment, the major left-wing party, favored territorial compromise. Well, with whom? On what? And the answer is one of three possibilities. Either the Kingdom of Jordan, the PLO, or local Arabs. So we'll see all three of those options are flawed, and Likud would take advantage of that.
Did the local Arabs have any cohesion?
So that's the problem. It's hard to find them. Autonomy. Who favored autonomy? The Likud. What is autonomy? No giving up of territory from a military standpoint, that Israel's border, security border, is the Jordan River. There are no foreign forces in Eretz Yisrael, but in the territories, in parts of the territories where there's a majority Arab population, they control their own affairs on domestic issues. And the fourth option is annexation. Who favored annexation? Well, the right-wing parties did. So we're talking about Tichia and Moledet, which is a new party which we haven't seen yet, and Tzomet, a new party which we haven't seen yet. So, of these options, some are easier to implement than others because they don't require anybody's cooperation. When you can do things unilaterally, that's great. When you have to have a partner in discussion, well, you have to find that partner, and that isn't always an easy thing. So let's now focus on the left side of the aisle first, the Alignment. Labour Party was being run by Shimon Peres, and this time around, there was no leadership contest. Yitzhak Rabin did not challenge Peres for the top job. Rather, if there was any challenge at all, it was from the fact that both Rabin and Peres were in their mid-60s by now, and there was rumbling at the bottom of the ladder saying, you guys are getting on in years. You're like Nadav and Avihu with Moshe and Aaron. It's time for the next generation to take over. So there's talk, but the talk was quickly squashed. Now, Peres is our leader. Rabin is the number two. The young guard will have to wait their turn. And they would have to wait a while because Rabin would be in charge in 92 and Peres in 96, and so it wouldn't be until Ehud Barak comes on the scene in 99 that you'd have anybody other than these two guys. And what is Peres' agenda this time around? Well, he decides that the Labour Party needs to put forth a very dovish image. Dovish image. Not a centrist image, a dovish image. That's a very risky proposition, because all the polling data indicated that the people were becoming more hawkish on the territories, and if you want to be a dovish party and win, it means you not only have to get your message out there, you have to actually convince voters to change their opinion. So most election cycles are about getting your constituency to put the piece of paper in the box and make sure they do it in large numbers. But you don't really think you're going to convince people who generally disagree with you to vote for you. Peres said, no, we have to bring the electorate to our side. So, what do you do to accomplish that? Well, you have to make sure that everyone thinks that Likud is an extremist party unworthy of governing, and that they have an opinion and a policy that is damaging to the interest of the state of Israel, and that your own policy will not be damaging to the state of Israel. So, what is the Labour Party's agenda? It is territorial compromise with the Arabs, however you might want to define them. So who's available? Well, in the beginning, it was King Hussein. King Hussein was Peres' favorite negotiating partner, except all these negotiations happened behind closed doors and in secret, and no one was supposed to know about it until London in April of 87. Then it became public knowledge and kind of fell apart. Well, things really fell apart after King Hussein announced, I'm not interested in getting the West Bank back. It's for the PLO. This is July 31st, 1988. So Peres is now has egg on his face. My guy, King Hussein, says, I'm not interested. What do you have left? Either the PLO or local Arabs. The PLO wants to kill the Jews and still has not recognized Israel's right to exist or renounced terrorism or recognized Resolution 242 of the United Nations. And the local Arabs have no heft. There's no, if you negotiate them, you're negotiating with nobodies. So it means nothing. So Peres really is at a loss for what to say. In the months before the election, after King Hussein made his announcement, the Labour Party spokespeople said, it's a reversible decision. He didn't really mean it permanently. In other words, the Jordanian option, ha'optia ha'yardanit, is not off the table. It may look like it because they made an announcement, but we can convince them to change their tune. Does that sound very convincing?
Why would the Jordanians want to have the West Bank? I mean, At that point, they did not.
But what was changing in the world in the mid to late 80s that led the alignment to think that King Hussein was a good partner for peace and that to run on a platform of negotiating with him could be a winning strategy? The answer is, first of all, the Jordanians were afraid to make peace with Israel so long as no other Arab state had done so. After Israel and Egypt made peace in 79 and it was implemented in 1982, now King Hussein would not be the first Arab, so he wouldn't get shot. In other words, Sadat took one for the team. So Hussein thinks to himself, I can make peace and not take a bullet to the head, which was true. He died of natural causes, died of cancer 15 years later. That's number one. Secondly, the PLO is no longer a thorn in his side. Where is the PLO at this point? In Tunisia. It's far away. Thirdly, the Arab world isn't focusing on the Palestinian issue. The Arab world is focusing on the Iran-Iraq war. So maybe you can get away with negotiations and not be front and center in the newspapers.
Yes.
Well, it's not clear that that's exactly why he was shot, but it was because he was too moderate on the issue of Zionism. Too moderate. Well, and most importantly, King Hussein recognized that after two decades of Israeli occupation of the territories, there was a significant percentage of the public in Israel that was ready for territorial compromise because they didn't want to have an indefinite occupation. And on that, Hussein was correct. The left side of the aisle is going to grow, but it wasn't until the 1990s that it had enough base of support to win an election and to put into place a policy.
Yeah, but wasn't there also the fact that internally among the Palestinians who were in the territories, that they had already been ruled without Hussein for so many years?
They didn't like him anymore. They didn't know him anymore.
He wasn't one of them.
That's true. That is definitely true. So, wait.
Just a clarification. Jordan canceled the citizenship or the passport?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
In 88.
Yes, it did. Yes, it was a real.
After that.
So they were stateless. Yes, they had to have Israeli documentation. They were residents of the territories. Okay, so Labor is running on this territorial compromise idea, and the way to implement it is to have an international peace conference that will lead to bilateral negotiations. Well, the Likud says, that's a terrible idea. That idea, a peace conference? Try the Munich Conference of 1938, and that Shimon Peres is Neville Chamberlain. So this was the kind of rhetoric that was being thrown around. Because what happens when you go to an international conference? You give over your destiny into the hands of arbitrators who do not have your interests at heart, whether it's the United States, or worse, the Soviet Union, or the Red Chinese, or the Europeans. So, and the Taba incident of going to arbitration and losing was seen as could be a forerunner or foreshadowing what would happen over the West Bank and Gaza. So that's the Likud criticism of the dovish position of Labor. Now, on the list of candidates was included a Peace Now representative, which up until that time had not happened. So the Likud, the right side of the aisle, said this list of the alignment is a very unimpressive list. These are people who are going to give away the store. How could you trust them? Well, as it turned out, the Likud was right about the likability or the popularity of the down-ballot candidates. When it came to Shamir versus Peres, Peres was more popular on the national level. But when it came to the down ballot folks, the Likud was more popular than the alignment. The Likud had some big names, people liked, and the alignment did not. Who was off the alignment's list? Abba Eban. Why? Because he couldn't get votes. They had an open primary, and nobody liked Abba Eban. It was a shanda. Because he was more popular in America than he was in Israel. When he died in 2002, Rabbi Lau at his funeral said, "We didn't give Abba the cover he deserved." You know, we, the Israeli people, as opposed to the Jewish people, didn't give him the cover he deserved.
Was he considered an outsider because of his British background?
He was considered an outsider because his Hebrew was with not an Israeli accent, and because he was aristocratic in nature in an otherwise socialist country. So, now let's go to the Likud side of the aisle. The Likud has a decision to make. Do they want to present themselves as a right-wing party or as a centrist party? And Shamir made a decision, we're going to go the centrist route. We are now a centrist mainstream party, we're not the right wing. We are the center of Israeli politics. Why did he do this? Because he wanted to imitate Ben-Gurion. What did Ben-Gurion do with the Mapai? The Mapai was about a 40% of the electorate, 35%, 40% each time in the good old days. They were not the majority, but they were the clear plurality. And they were to the left of center. But what did Ben-Gurion do? He said to everyone, we are the center. And if you're to the right of us, you're the right. And if you're to the left of us, you're the left. And to make a coalition, we'll take a little bit from the right and a little bit from the left and a little bit from the knitted yarmulke wearers. And we'll have a government. And it worked fine for 29 years. Okay? Well, Shamir is saying this. We represent mainstream opinion of holding on to the territories and capitalist economy, basically. If you disagree with us because you're to the right, well, you're a right-wing lunatic. And if you're to the left of us, you're not a centrist. You're a left-wing lunatic. Did it work? Basically, it did, because they won the election. Not with as large a number of seats as they would have wanted, but they won. Now, how do you present centrism? What do you do to prove centrism? What do you do?
Try to be reasonable.
Exactly. So no hooliganism. No bad behavior in public. The alignment tried to goat the right wing into having riots in the streets with tomato throwing and all the like, but it didn't happen. In 81, it happened a lot. In 84, it happened to a limited extent. In 88, the Likud ran a business-like campaign. No bad behavior by anybody. And what do we say in public, and who does the speaking? Well, there's one man who will not be allowed in front of a camera, and it wasn't Chuck Schumer. Ariel Sharon, bingo. Ariel Sharon was not allowed in front of a camera during the 88 election cycle because he was considered like a bulvan by the left and by the center. And if you have him as your guy, then nobody who's not a right winger is going to vote for you. All right, so who does the speaking? Benjamin Netanyahu and Moshe Ahrens speak to the international community. Why? Because they speak English fluently. And they put forth a good image, you know, cleaned up. They do well in front of the international audience. And domestically, who's going to do the speaking? Well, Ahrens is going to do some of it, but also Shamir himself, David Levy for the Sephardic vote, and others down the ballot, but not Sharon. And what's going to be said? Well, Moshe Ahrens gets up and announces, we favor municipal elections in the territories. In other words, we're not going to have an apartheid system and a rough and tough occupation. We're going to give the people in the West Bank some hope to live for, municipal elections. And maybe, just maybe, other relaxation of limits on their activities. Okay, what else? The Likud party gobbled up elements of the old center. The Tommy Party and the Ometz Party, which ran in the 84 election, were incorporated into the Likud. Also, the Liberal Party, which had been an element of the Likud since the days of Gachal, now ceased to exist and joined with Chayrut in a united, unified Likud party. So they're together, biyachad, and there is no center. So unlike today, April 9th, 2019, when Gantz and Lapid represented the center, and Likud is the right, and Labor Merits is the left. In 1988, there was no center party. There was no center party, which means that the major party that claims to be gravitating towards the center is more likely to capture the floating voter. And the floating voter is what wins or loses an election. Okay, so this was a very good strategy on the part of the Likud. All done by Shamir. He understood that this is the way to go if you want to win. Okay. But, yeah. All right, so that's an important point. He had a bad reputation in the eyes of many from his days of Lehi. And in order to negate or to blunt the force of Shimon Peres's criticisms that Shamir can't deal with international figures, all throughout 1988, what did Shamir do? He met with heads of state. He met with American Jewish leaders at the UJA meetings and the breakfasts and all that. He made sure that the media was covering his interaction with other dignified Western people, Jew and Gentile alike.
Even though he didn't speak so well, but he was there.
Right, he was there. He shook hands nicely. And this way you can't claim that he's unable to function in a Western setting. Now, what labor would argue is that Yitzhak Shamir, if the discussion was about the peace process, could never look you in the eye while speaking to you, because really he was lying through his teeth. Now, is that a fair criticism? Probably. He was lying through his teeth. Shamir had no intention of being conciliatory on the territories. That was his life's dream, Eretz Yisrael, and he had to do whatever he could to get through the conversation, but was completely dishonest. Okay. Now let's go to the religious parties, because the fun in 1988 was with the religious parties. The Haredim and the National Religious did very well that year. In fact, greater representation than ever before, 18 seats between the religious parties. To what do we attribute this? Especially considering they were down to 13 in the previous go-round.
The first Knesset, what was the
time? 16. It was always 16 or 17, every single time, once it was 15, all throughout the days of the Mapai leadership, and then it fell down in the Likud era, but then shot back up in 1988. So what happened here? Well, 84 was a disaster. Aguda had 2 seats. The NRP had 4. It was embarrassing. They were not representing their people properly, and they didn't know what they were doing. Shas had 4 in their opening gamble in politics in 1984. But what happened 4 years later? The answer is the base was galvanized and mobilized. Everyone was going to vote. And why were they going to vote? Because they had someone to vote for. If you liked this type of religion, it was a party for you. If you liked that type of religion, it was a party for you. What am I talking about? The Aguda had a breakdown. The Hasidim and Misnagdim finally broke apart because they couldn't get along anymore. All throughout the early period of the state, the Aguda held firm. There was the Poli Aguda, but the Aguda itself held firm despite uneasy tension between Misnagdim and Hasidim. But once the Aguda was in government and given perks, benefits of power, what's the most important benefit? The money. And when you have money, you fight over money. Is my institution going to get the money or is your institution going to get the money? So in 1984, Rav Shach encouraged the Sephardim to break away and form Shas. And it happened under Rabbi Avadya Yosef's leadership. But in 1988, Rav Shach decided, you know what, we, the Misnagdim, are going to break away and form Degel HaTorah and try to get our people to vote from the yeshiva culture for our party and not for the Aguda. Who was running the show for the Aguda? The Lubavitcher Rebbe out of 770 Eastern Parkway. So although the Gerer Hasidim typically controlled the Aguda for many, many years, in 88, Chabad was the primary influence. Why was Chabad so interested in running the show? 2 reasons. First of all, personal feud with Rav Shach. Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson and Rav Shach hated each other, Chas v'Shalom. And so there's that personal issue. And also, the Chabad are real right-wingers, politically. Chabad are the biggest Zionists of them all. They're not Zionists at all, but they're the biggest Zionists of them all simultaneously.
Exact opposite, that they're anti-Zionists.
Right, so they're simultaneously the biggest anti-Zionists and the biggest Zionists, in the sense that on matters of the territories, the Rebbe believed not 1 inch, not 1 inch, not 1 millimeter. Okay, so he needs to have the right wing win. He doesn't want to have a Peres government. He wants to have a Shamir government. And he wants Chabad institutions in Israel to be well-funded. So although in every prior cycle he refused to give direct instructions as to who to vote for, now it was, you must vote for the Aguda. By the way,
how did he get along with Menachem Parrish?
I don't know. That's a good question. But the Chabadniks used to vote for Poalei Aguda. Now, Poalei Aguda was a right-wing party politically, but Poalei Aguda didn't make the threshold in the early 80s. So they folded into the Aguda, which helped the right-wingers, the Not One Inch crowd, take over the party. So what had once been a party that only cared about yeshivas and Shabbos and chametz on Pesach and no pork, now had a mainstream political agenda of being in a right-wing government. Yeah.
I wanted to say, I was on the plane before the election.
Yeah.
And it was filled with a lot of Chabadniks that were...
Right, if you had citizenship, you were told to go vote. It's true.
Right.
Yeah.
So many people, Chabad, died in Israel.
So Chabad was very influential in Israel, including with the Sephardim. Now let's talk about the Sephardim. Shas, which won 6 seats in this go-around, wanted to capture the attention of all the Sephardic voters, but they couldn't. They were in direct competition with the Aguda over Sephardic voters. The Baba Sali crowd did not vote for Shas, they voted for Aguda. And the Baba Sali, who died a few years earlier, his sons were solicited for their blessing, Kabbalistic blessing, and it was for Aguda voters. The real question would be, those Sephardic Jews who were Balei Tshuva, who became Balei Tshuva under the auspices of Chabad, will they vote for Shas or will they vote for the Aguda? That was the major question. And they split the difference. So both parties did well. Now what about the NRP? So the NRP was bolstered by the fact that Rav Drukman, who had broken away the previous go-around, rejoined the party. And so they ended up with 5 seats. They did okay. The biggest problem for the NRP was, what if our voters want to vote for Likud? Because they're worried if we don't vote for the Likud, Shimon Peres will become the prime minister. That's an ongoing problem that all knitted yarmulke wearer types have, including in this election. Okay, what do you do? Do you vote for the boutique party or do you vote for the major party? And some people pick this and some people pick that. It's hard to know ahead of time. Polling data doesn't really tell you the story. What it tells you the story is the exit, you know, the end results when they count the ballots.
What was the main problem between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim? You know, in the end, what did they really fight at?
Personality clashes.
They were personality.
Yeah. But Rav Shach believed very fervently that Chabad messianism was a cult. And he said so in unambiguous terms, that the Rebbe is to be faulted for not stamping out the messianism.
But even before that, yeah. It was strains between the Hasidim.
Well, different.
Israel, what was the main problem between them?
I'm not so sure that there was a real ideological problem. Sometimes it's a territorial issue of this is this neighborhood for us, this is something for you guys, or a financial issue. There's limited resources, and who's going to get it? Okay, so what about the Arabs? Who are the Arabs going to vote for? This time around, about 58% of the Arabs voted for either the communists or the 2 Arab parties that end up crossing the threshold, which means 42% of them voted for Jewish parties, including 20-some-odd percent that voted for the alignment. So the second largest party among the Arab voters was Labor. Does that make sense? Yeah, it makes sense, because the Arab voter is interested in having an Israeli government that's not a right-wing government, that's conciliatory towards the Palestinians, and may actually trade territory for peace. But they were not the only Jewish party that got some votes. Shinui and Citizens' Rights got votes. Why? Because if you're an Arab citizen of Israel, you're an ethnic minority who feels oppressed and that you haven't had your full rights respected by the government and by the police and by whatever other bureaucracy you're dealing with, then you're going to vote for a party that's agenda is equality for all, or at least says it's for equality for all. Okay. So, what were the results? Let's take a look at the results. Likud won 40, Labor won 39, Shas 6, Aguda 5, Citizens' Rights 5, National Religious Party 5, Chadash, the Communists 4, Tichiyah 3, Mapam 3, Tzomet 2, Moledet 2, Shinoi 2, Degel HaTorah 2, Progressive List for Peace 1, and Arab Democratic Party 1. So the numbers work out that there were 2 Arab seats, 4 communists, so 2 plus 4 equals 6, 18 religious, 7 far right, and only a handful of far left. Maybe about 10 to the left of labor. Who wins? Who loses? Does Likud win just because it's 40-39? No. Everybody understood from 1984 that the plurality is not the winner. The winner is whichever side of the aisle wins. And here, the religious right won. 65 seats. 40 for Likud, 7 for the far right, and 18 for the religious. 47 plus 18 is 65. So, what's the logical outcome of this election? A narrow right-wing religious government. Did it happen? No. And why didn't it happen? Because Yitzhak Shamir didn't want it to happen. David Levy and Ariel Sharon desperately wanted it to happen. Oh, they wanted it bad. But Shamir thought better. Why? Because he realized it's better to be the right wing, the hawkish wing of a national unity government, than it is to be the dovish wing of a right wing government. Does that make sense?
No.
Well, if you assume that in a national unity government where there is no rotation of prime minister, you are the boss for all 4 years, that you can control foreign policy, then it doesn't really matter that there's a left-wing party, a major one, that gets to the share of some of the portfolios. And in fact, it makes you look more conciliatory and better in the eyes of the international community because you're not just a horrible chauvinist, but rather you can cooperate with the other side. So that Shamir, in Shamir's calculation, that was the advantage. Also, there were certain things that Moledet, Tzomet, Techia wanted in terms of annexation that Shamir was never going to be able to deliver. And he worried that at any moment they could bolt from the government and he would lose his job. So the safer play was to go with Shimon Peres than it was to go with Geula Cohen and Rachavam Ze'evi and the hardliners. So, yeah? He knew that, and in 1990 it almost happened. In 1990, the stinking maneuver, the most ugly episode in Israeli history, which we'll talk about next time, almost knocked him out of the box. But he was willing to take a chance. So the other factor is, Shamir did not want to be beholden to the religious parties on religious issues. He did not want to be subject to blackmail and gamesmanship, brinksmanship. So he wants a big government, but he doesn't want to have a rotation. Now, how do you avoid the rotation when the 40-39 near tie? The answer is, first, you negotiate with the right wing and the religious, and then once you have them in your pocket, you go to Shimon Peres and say, "My good friend Shimon, you want to be in the government?" And Shimon says, "Of course I do, but you can't be prime minister." Okay, that's how it works. So first you go to the NRP, the most obvious partner, and the NRP gets a few spoils of war. Good, fine. Then you go to the Aguda, you give them a few things. And remember, they don't want ministries because they are objecting ideologically to taking portfolios. They just want money and chairmanship in the Knesset. Good, they're in the pocket. Then you go to Shas, and you give Aryeh Deri something, and he's in your pocket. Now you have 65. Well, actually, you don't have 65, you have 58. With the potential for more, because the other right-wing parties could be in your pocket soon. And then you go to Shimon and say, "Listen, we already have a government, but I want you involved." And Shimon says yes. And then the religious parties turn around and say, "Wait a second, you deceived us, Yitzhak Shamir." And Shamir says, "Yeah, what are you going to do about it?" And that's the end of the story. Okay, so who gets what? Well, the goal was to keep the left wing out of foreign policy. So, Peres gets the treasury portfolio, the finance ministry. Now, that's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's very powerful. You control the money. On the other hand, if you don't do it well, people hate your guts. Because who's the most despised member of any government when the economy is not good? The finance minister, because he has to make cuts and he doesn't give you what you want. So, Peres took a chance on finance, but he had to accept it. Beggars can't be choosers. Defense goes to Yitzhak Rabin. Why Yitzhak Rabin? He's the man. He's been doing a good job for the past 4 years. Let the man continue. We don't need to have a Likudnik in the defense portfolio. After all, he's been doing a pretty good job of suppressing the Intifada. Now, who gets the other portfolios in the Likud? Well, the top guys. Levy, Sharon, Ahrens, and the like. and they'll have to split it between them. But let's now talk about the Intifada. Was the public satisfied with Rabin's handling of the Intifada? Yes or no? So, interestingly, most of the Likud party thought he was doing a pretty good job. They didn't want to disparage him. The far left, Shinui, Mapam, Citizens' Rights, complained that there was barbarism going on, that the IDF was shooting without just cause, and the Palestinian civil rights were being violated. Human rights, human rights. That was the left side of the aisle. The right side of the aisle, the Moledit crowd, said the limitations on IDF engagement of firing weapons was too stringent. We should be more relaxed in who we shoot. So, of course, this is going to be the case. The right wing wants to shoot more often, and the left wing wants to shoot less often. And Rabin is somewhere in the middle. Okay, but he satisfied what Shamir needed, and he kept the job of defense minister. He would hold it from 84 to 1990. Well, is there a solution to the Intifada? Is there a solution? Is there a political solution? Is there a military solution? So here you have a machlokus between the various parties. Techiya would say, break the Intifada now. That was their slogan. There's peace now, and there's break the Intifada now. Which means, with the right amount of brute force, you can get it done. Then Somet said, their slogan was, there is a solution to the Intifada. Now, why would someone say there's a solution to the Intifada? Because other people are saying there is no solution other than a political one. Someone is saying, no, there is a solution, and it's a military one. You know, be rough and tough, and eventually they'll collapse. Moledit. Let's talk about Moledit. So their position was voluntary transfer. How does voluntary transfer differ from coerced transfer? So money could be an issue, but then again, even Kahanists were saying you can give money. Voluntary transfer means if they don't agree, they don't agree. They can't leave. But it's important to recognize, and I don't know if last week I made this distinction, which Arabs were the focus of Kahana's attention and which Arabs were the focus of Moledit's attention? Kahana was focusing on Israeli Arabs, because they are citizens and they could vote the Jewish state out of existence. So he wants the elimination of Israeli Arab citizens. Let them go to Canada or New Zealand or wherever.
Uganda.
Moledit is focused on not Israeli Arabs, but rather the Arabs in the West Bank and Gaza. They are not Israeli citizens. They have no rights. We can sort of boss them around a little bit and ask them nicely to leave. Who favored Moledit's point of view of voluntary transfer? So officially, only Moledit. However, Techiya and Soma didn't rule it out either. So almost the whole right wing, regardless of whether the religious right or the secular right, had on their mind, maybe we could change the demographic balance if we really tried. Why is it necessary for them to think this way? Because they're annexationists. And if you're an annexationist and you don't think about transfer, what's the end result?
You
don't have a Jewish state anymore. You have a binational state or an Arab state. So this is what the hard right has to say to itself. We favor some kind of a demographic change by having people leave under whatever circumstances. Now, the Likud does not agree to that. The Likud, as the so-called center party or the moderate right party, does not believe in changing the demographics by having people leave. So they have to have something else for the people who remain behind, namely autonomy. But the autonomy isn't good if the demographic balance favors the Arabs in the long run. In other words, if the Jews are a minority 10 years out, 20 years out, 30 years out, 40 years out, then autonomy looks a lot like apartheid. So what does the Likud say to labor when labor criticizes Likud's policies, saying you're basically promoting an unfair system, the South Africa type system? You can't do this. This is bad for Israel. What's the Likud's response? Mind your own business. So the Likud's response is, if the Labour Party had this kind of defeatist attitude in 1928 as it has in 1988, there never would have been a state of Israel. In other words, you have to have faith. NRP said explicitly, you have to have faith that the numbers are going to work out in our favor, even though in the here and now, the numbers look really bad. Yeah?
Why I mean, this was before the influx of Russian Jews.
Correct.
So what were the demographers at that time saying? What were they actually predicting?
They were saying that by 2020, it's a majority Arab.
Because they were probably gaining.
Well, the Arab birth rate was much higher than the Jewish rate, although over the years the gap has narrowed, and now, from what I can tell, it's I think it's almost the same.
But why risk alienating domestic Israeli Arabs, Bedouins, Druze, all of that with that kind of policy?
So the answer to that is that far right wingers don't tend to think about the feelings of ethnic minorities, especially the ones that have otherwise been loyal, when they come up with their plan that is an essential component of retaining Eretz Yisrael Hashleima. Meaning when your goal is territorial maximalism, you have to come up with some policy, or at least a vision of a policy, in terms of the numbers of people that are in the country. The fact that it is antagonistic to certain groups that otherwise are well behaved and well integrated, they tend to not focus on that.
Two things. First thing is the NRP, to my mind, sounds very Pollyannish. Doesn't everybody see the same thing that I see? I mean, you're going to say, oh, you have faith. I mean, come on. That's number one.
Uh-huh.
And the second thing is, 2 weeks ago you were talking about Kahana,
right,
with the shifting of the population.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think you also did mention the question of India and Pakistan. It never worked.
Well, in Europe it did. In India, Pakistan, it led to ongoing conflict over the next bunch of decades. So, as for Kahana, one of the best ways that Likud was able to present itself as a moderate party, a so-called centrist party, was to lead in the vanguard of banning Kahana from the Knesset. Kick him out! So a party that kicks out Kahana looks quite reasonable, even though its policy on the territories is pretty far to the right.
Everything is relative,
but if you kick out the guy that's further to the right, you look much more moderate. Okay, so what happened? Why was Kahana so popular? This is one of the great historical questions about right-wing Zionism. Why in 1988 was Kahana so popular? What did you hear on the radio and the TV 30 years ago about how Kahana was doing in the polls? What did they say? You remember what they used to say?
He was great, though.
He was doing real well. How many seats was he going to win? 8 seats, 9 seats, 10 seats. He was going to be the third largest party in the Knesset. That's what everyone was saying on the radio and the TV shortly before he was banned. Why was he doing so well? But why was his demagoguery effective in 88 more so than in 84, 81, or 77? So I'll tell you three things. One, the Intifada. Two, the absence of a charismatic figure on the right side of the aisle. So long as Menachem Begin was alive and functioning, Kahana could not capture the attention of the religious and Sephardic and right-wing masses that are looking for this the cult-like leader. Shamir never had that kind of aura about him, never. So Kahana filled the void. But lastly, and maybe most importantly, when Likud was angling towards the center, he was moving towards a middle position, everybody saw it. Now, for the floating voter who wants a centrist party, that's a very attractive thing. But if you're a hardliner who was accustomed to voting for the Likud, and all of a sudden you see them espousing moderate positions, or doing things that a right-wing party wouldn't typically do, and sidelining Ariel Sharon, well, what's your answer? If I'm not going to vote for Likud, I'll vote for Kahana. And so Kahana went up in the polls and then was crushed. Out. Can't vote for him. The voters who were disgruntled with the Likud and who wished to vote for Kahana but couldn't because he was banned, who did they vote for in the end? The answer is they voted for Aguda and Shas. The religious ones, the frum ones, voted for the Aguda, and the Sephardim voted for Shas. But did they really punish the Likud in the process? No, the joke was on them.
Coalition?
Because the coalition included the Aguda and Shas, and they helped put Shamir over the top to win the election. So what do we learn from this? We learn something very important, that sometimes a protest vote doesn't actually function as a protest vote. You actually can be shooting yourself in the foot, because if the people who are your alternative are just patsies of the big guy who you're disgruntled with, you haven't really punished anyone. You'd have to really cross to the other side completely to punish the guys you don't like. And is your average voter willing to do that? No, your average voter is not willing to do that. So intra-block shifting doesn't change the outcome. Only inter-block shifting changes the outcome, and most voters will not do that. Therefore, election results are typically predictable, even though the Knesset alignment, the numbers are not so predictable.
Why is it then, and if I'm off the topic, stop me, in today's paper they were talking about Netanyahu and also Gantz saying don't vote for the right wing or don't vote for the left wing.
Yeah, yeah.
Vote for us in general. It seems that it doesn't make any difference. Why did it make a difference?
So the specific party that you vote for does matter, in the sense that if the president of the country is going to pick the winner that has the plurality and the party that you want but didn't end up voting for doesn't get the plurality but finishes second, it could mean that you'll be very disappointed 2 weeks later, when the government is formed. And you always have to worry about that. So people make their choices at the last minute. Now, one thing that's important about this election, there was no talk at all of class struggle, which means that the Labour Party is no longer the Labour Party. Of course, by now, 30 years later, it's obvious. The Labour Party are just a bunch of rich people who live in high-rises in Tel Aviv. But the Labour Party was a real socialist party for a long time. By the late 80s, it's not. Who represents real socialism? The Mapam. The Mapam won 3 seats. Nothing. Okay. Labour represents the hodgepodge of people who hold moderate and left-of-center views on issues generally, specifically on the territories. But it's not espousing socialism like it had in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even into the 70s. That is long over. Okay. Another thing, what is the ability of in the religious world, the left-wing religious vote? Do they have a chance of accomplishing anything? When I say left-wing, I mean on matters of war and peace, and also on matters of religion. So, Degel HaTorah of Rav Shach was a left-of-center party on matters of war and peace. He believed, negotiate with the Arabs, give away territory, unlike the Aguda. But that doesn't mean that the Degel HaTorah was about to be in cahoots with a Labour government. First of all, there wasn't going to be a Labour government, and Degel HaTorah wants the perks of being in power, so they'll join a coalition that's on the right side of the aisle. But in theory, they are okay with territorial compromise. That is important going into the 1990s, when maybe, just maybe, you'll finally elect a left-wing government, and the view of the Haredim will be significant. What about if you're a modern Orthodox left-winger? What do you do then? So you vote for Meimad. Meimad was founded by Rav Amital, Rosh Yeshiva of Gush Etzion, together with Rav Lichtenstein. So there's a certain irony that the leader of left-wing modern Orthodoxy was himself a settler. But that's a sort of an accident of history, that he's in Gush Etzion, but he's a left-winger on the matters of the territories. So did they cross the threshold? The answer is they got 0.7%. A nice number, but not enough to get in. They never would get in, except when Rav Melchior, who was the leader of the party, was incorporated into One Israel, into the Labour Party, a decade later. So there isn't enough left-wing modern Orthodox Jews to bring someone into the Knesset on their own merits. There only are right-wing modern Orthodox Jews, or religious Zionist Jews. And they will be the NRP until the NRP fizzles out, 20 years later and joins the Union of Right-Wing Parties. But just to keep in mind, there were people of that ilk in this country. If you remember, there was the Shvil HaZahav. Who remembers the Shvil HaZahav? A bunch of New York area rabbis, including maybe from this neighborhood, although probably not this neighborhood, who were in favor of Oslo. And they had some representation in the American Orthodox rabbinate. But in Israel, They were always just a very small group that couldn't get off the ground. So that's why religious Zionism politically meant right-wing Zionism, not left-wing Zionism. Just the numbers worked out that way. Okay, we'll stop here.